Today we're going to have an overview of the February forecast that we received March 3rd, I believe. We have Commissioner Hansen here from Finance, Mr. Showalter, and our state economist, Dr. Stinson. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity to be here, and thank you. I know you adjusted your committee schedule to accommodate us this week, and we appreciate that as well. We're going to be referencing, I think you all have a copy of our slides. It's a three-part presentation. I'll provide some overview comments, Mr. Chairman, and you'll see the story, as you've probably seen already, the story of the forecast is twofold. One is the worsening economy that Dr. Stinson will talk about it, as he usually does, and Jim Showalter, our state budget director, will talk about the federal stimulus and its impact on this forecast. But if you look at the first slide, the budget gap, the number that we are working with is $4.57 billion. But it's important to note that but for the saving, the federal stimulus, you'll see that the medical assistance money we have received from the federal government is automatically included in the forecast because we have prior statutory authority to do so. We don't have that statutory authority on any of the other funds. So without the 1.8, our gap would have been $6.4 billion. If you look at the second chart, you'll see a little more. The numbers we show you, the if you remember, it was 4.847 the November forecast. You can see that the decline of revenues is 1.1, almost $1.2 billion, and some minor spending changes of $152 million, not a big part of this forecast, but that the federal stimulus amount we are booking in 10 and 11, and Jim will talk about why that is, $1.359 billion of the stimulus in 10 and 11, and we're carrying a balance forward. The other, good news in this forecast is we don't have a deficit in our 2008-2009 biennium. We have a surplus of $236 million that we're carrying forward into 10 and 11. Then on the next page, you see $236 million for 2008-09, and then 10 and 11, it's 4.8. It amounts to a 4.5 over 3 years. With that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Stinson. Jim, I'm sorry.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter. I'm not a doctor. But I will still present you with the information on the federal stimulus package. On the next slide, it shows you the information that we've been talking about for a few weeks now, that our initial estimates based upon FFIS, federal funds information for states data, suggested Minnesota would get about $4.6 billion.
Senator Pullman.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. This is the set you were working on, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I wanted to ask you.
And then I didn't.
Oh, sure.
Senator Pogman.
The one that has the third page, I guess, higher than 1.2, it has lower revenues, higher spending, federal stimulus. That one?
This one.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not too certain here, but just looking at this chart, it seems like revenues. 1.1 billion less revenue. I don't know if anybody else reads it. Looks like we have a revenue
problem
because the spending actually
has gone down. Is that, am I reading this correctly? Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, it's the spending, it's in relation to the forecast. The spending actually has gotten worse. Like the.
So 152 is up.
The lower revenues, it is a revenue. From the December to the February forecast, it is a revenue problem. You can see that that's a fairly significant drop in revenue, but, you know, from a, as you well know, from a November to a February forecast. Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Well, Senator Pogemiller, on the actual forecast highlights, I noticed in the first paragraph, if you look at the last sentence in the first paragraph, it says, in both this forecast and the November forecast, expected revenues fall short of projected expenditures by more than 13%. So kind of to your point. And we, Mr. Schwalter.
Mr. Chair, just to that point, also on the last table that you see on this striped document, I believe, that is available, you'll see just a biennial comparison of expenditures and revenues from 8 and 9 to 10 and 11, and you'll see by area how revenues have fallen short of expectations and then also changes in spending. I think on the bottom line you see that total current resources are down by about 5%, 4.8%. And during that same period, expenditures are up about the same amount, about 4.7%, 4.8% if you include dedicated. But the changes that we've seen in both the November forecast and, in, of course, in this February forecast are on the revenue side for the most part.
Well, Senator Pogemiller.
Chairman, that's excellent. I'm glad you pointed that out. So we want to look at revenues are down about 4.8% and expenditures are up 4.7%. Mm-hmm. Kind of half and half. So, thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, looking at the stimulus information on the next page, what you see is just a quick overview. Much of the funding is available to the state through existing federal programs. Some of the initial talk was that it's all in the competitive grants or that it's somehow going to all become available for budget relief, and that is just not the case. Certainly a couple of big chunks are available for general fund budget relief, but much of it will come through traditional federal programs that are dedicated purposes and will be outside of the general fund discussion. In this forecast, one major piece is included, and that is the FMAP change. FMAP stands for Federal Matching Funds. It represents how much the federal government pays for every Medicaid dollar that's spent. In Minnesota, traditionally, it's 50%. Based upon the stimulus bill, that will be changing to roughly 60%. It's essentially a discount for the state. Instead of paying 50%, we'll be paying 40%. That translates into lower spending. That was reflected in this forecast.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Langsa.
Mr. Chair, doesn't the federal government come up with between 50 and 75 based upon states per capita income or something? It does go up to 75%, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's a couple of different things going on. One is states already receive between 50% and I think up to in the 90s, depending on the personal income of the state. So everyone's starting from a different playing field. And then there's bonus points based upon, I believe it is, the unemployment numbers that or the jobs changes that are going on state by state. And so there's some level of bonus FMAP increase that can be received. Minnesota was in some of the higher ranking areas, and so that our benefit out of the stimulus bill was relatively strong. So it's both a base, sort of a starting point, and then also some kind of bonus that comes from the stimulus bill. On the next page, Mr. Chair and members, we just have a simple chart that shows you the types of stimulus funding. You'll see that the first two boxes, the Medicaid match and the state stabilization, are essentially countercyclical funding sources for states to help pay for basic expenditures, both in health care and in education, K-12 and higher education, providing some resources to make sure that those activities continue. We received $1.8 billion in a Medicaid match. That's included in the lower spending numbers in this forecast. The state stabilization money is not included in this forecast. There's no current law authority to receive or spend this money and will be certainly part of the discussion in budget proposals. Dedicated funding, about $2 billion. That includes some of the highway funds, drinking water facilities, many, many other programs nearly 100 in total. And then the competitive grants, which we're still receiving information as to what exactly those programs are going to be. Those are really totally new programs that Minnesota will try to compete for. The next page, just moving along, just gives you a good graphic of how state medical assistance spending is affected in this forecast due to the stimulus bill. The overall growth in healthcare is not affected by the stimulus bill, and that overall growth is affected by the total bars that you see in front of you. However, the state receives a discount over the period of 2009 through 2011. In effect, those white portions that are identified in dollar amounts are how much less the state of Minnesota would spend based upon our current law spending projections. So the state will spend a little less for those couple of years. If, in fact, we change our overall Medicaid spending rate, the discount also changes. It doesn't increase the deficit. It just means that the federal match goes down as well. That is the major elements of the stabilization funding and how it affects this forecast. If there's no other questions, I'll turn it over to Dr. Stinson to talk about the economy.
Dr. Stinson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm on the slide that says revenue forecast revised lower. That probably shouldn't come as any surprise to anybody given all the news that we've had about how weak the economy is. And obviously, a weaker economy leads to...
Mr. Chairman, could you ask Professor Stinson to speak louder, please?
Maybe we can pull the mic a little closer, yeah. Dr. Stinson.
Thank you.
For fiscal year 2009, revenues are down $213 million compared to forecast in November. $133 million of that reflected simply actual receipts falling short of the forecast for the months of November, December, and January. $133 million of that came in the corporate income tax. About 60% of that was year-to-date receipts. The income and the sales tax were down $83 and $84 million, respectively. Again, a substantial portion of both of those just reflected the failure of receipts to keep up with the November forecast. For 2009, what really has happened primarily is that the losses that we've had in receipts thus far were just extended into to the end of the fiscal year. For 2010-2011, the changes are more significant. Revenues are down $1.166 billion compared to November's forecast. The individual income tax is down $701 million. There was a major change in our thinking about the individual income tax that I'll talk about in a minute regarding capital gains. We revised our estimate as to how much of a decline in capital gains there was going to be. Wages also are now expected to be weaker in 2010 and 2011 than we had in the forecast. The income tax is down $701 million, sales tax down $202 million, the corporate tax down $230 million. It's really unusual to see a revenue change of this magnitude between a November forecast and a February forecast. Typically, what happens in that period is that there's only a small change in the outlook for the U.S. economy, and the information that we have on revenues doesn't change very much. This time it was different because the economy's changed. It's also different because our outlook for capital gains has changed. The next slide shows you our new capital gains forecast and the old capital gains forecast. For tax year 2008, we've revised our estimate of the decline in capital gains realizations down slightly, down to 35% decline from 30% decline. But in November, we had a 10% further decline in tax year 2009. At this point, we think that was way too optimistic, and we now have changed our outlook to a 40% decline, a further 40% decline on top of the 35% decline in tax year 2009. There's still risk that that we could have been too optimistic even at a 40% decline. Certainly there's risk that we were too optimistic that capital gains realizations were only going to decline by 35% in tax year 2008. The CBO has a larger decline. Some states, California, Massachusetts, New York, also have larger declines in capital gains built into their forecasts for fiscal year 2009. We think that we're in an appropriate position given that we don't have as much capital gains coming from sale of houses as do California, New York, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C. area. So we think that we're in the right position relative to Minnesota, but we won't know whether we were right or not until mid-May. And of course, if we were wrong and off significantly, that could create a budget problem for the state. So we're still cautioning you that there needs to be some cushion left to protect against a budget shortfall that arises very late in the fiscal year and isn't really visible until that point. Mr. Chairman, the next slide shows the changes in the economy. How the economy has changed since the November forecast. We're in a recession. There's absolutely no doubt about it. We're in what is almost certain to be the longest and deepest recession since World War II. There are still changes coming on the negative side in terms of the outlook for calendar year 2009 economic growth. In there, the graph that has the bars and the lines in it says titled Global Insights February Forecast Contains a Deep Recession, shows the change between November and February. And you can see how the first half of 2009 has changed dramatically in terms of the growth rate. Since the February baseline forecast was prepared by Global Insight, we've gotten new information on how the economy performed during the second half of the fourth quarter of 2008, and that little tiny black bar that goes down to the left of the longer extending black bar. Now, with the current data that we have, that would extend about two-thirds of the way down to the to that 2% level. And so history has gotten worse, and unfortunately, for most forecasters, the prospective outlook has gotten worse as well. We've gotten information from Blue Chip Financial Forecast, from Mark Zandi's MoodysEconomy.com, from David Weiss at Standard & Poor's, and from other private forecasters as well. They've all lowered their forecast for the current year down by somewhere between half or three-quarters of a percentage point and a percentage point. Global Insights also lowered their forecast for the current year down noticeably in their March forecast. And so
Dr. Stinson, in the February forecast, weren't we forecasting negative 2.7% GDP growth? Has the number gotten, are you saying the number has gotten worse since we presented the February forecast?
Mr. Chairman, yes, Global Insight now expects negative 3.7.
3.7?
Yes. That's for calendar 2009. Now, Mr. Chairman, that's a noticeable change in the forecast. We don't necessarily go in lockstep with the national economic outlook, and in fact, in our February forecast, if you look in the forecast book, you'll see that we were more pessimistic than Global Insight's national forecast in terms of wage growth for Minnesota and in terms of employment growth for Minnesota. And so there's a question as to, one, whether Global Insight is overly pessimistic. They're more pessimistic than the blue chip consensus. So they're actually more pessimistic than anybody else at this point. And then there's a second question as to whether we have, by what we've done in our Minnesota forecast, how much of that lower outlook we've already anticipated in our forecast. So the real test is going to be how do revenues from the income tax withholding and how do gross sales tax receipts hold up over the next few months, whether we've anticipated this correctly or not. And of course, that's not something we'll know. For the month of February, receipts are almost perfectly on track with the forecast, which might not surprise you since the forecast came out after February was over with, although we didn't know the exact numbers at the time we did the forecast. But the real test will be really the months of April and the months of April and May as to how we're doing there. There are really three key questions that people ask and want to know the answers to about the economic outlook. The first is, how long is the recession going to last? And at this point, it looks like it's going to last pretty well until the end of the year. If you listen to Chairman Bernanke over the last week or so, his statements have been that if credit markets return to more normal status, not normal status, but just something closer to normal than they are now, some undefined level closer to, that it's likely that the economy will turn up by the end of the year. So he is not saying that the economy is going to turn up in July or August or by the end of the summer or anything like that. But people are looking on out into the latter part of 2009 or early 2010 before real GDP starts to turn up, and they're expecting that unemployment will continue to go up until mid-2010. Global Insight, in their current forecast, their March forecast, has unemployment holding at about 10.3% through much of 2010.
10.3% for all of 2010?
For much of 2010. I think the fourth quarter it may come down a little bit.
Jeez. And Dr. Simpson, where are we at today in Minnesota?
I honestly don't know. I think we're at 7.6 because I don't think the February numbers have come out. The U.S. numbers are at 8.2, and one would expect that Minnesota would track more or less the U.S. rate, and so I would expect the next unemployment numbers to be in the 8s. But I don't think that the February number is not out yet. I don't think that's out for another week or so.
Senator Double.
And Mr. Chair, that's the conventional index we use, the folks who are actively looking for work, that not the people who have kind of fallen off the radar.
That's right.
That have given up or whatever.
Yeah.
That could be more.
There's another index that includes people that are the discouraged worker phenomenon, which are people that have given up looking for work. There's an index that also includes people who are working part-time for economic reasons, not because...
Not by choice.
By choice, yes. And those numbers are quite a bit higher.
So, Dr. Stinson, if unemployment is going to hold through most of 2010 at 10.3%, what does that do for consumer confidence? And kind of, if unemployment's going to hold that high, I mean, and do the people still working, at what point do they kind of resume spending and we start to climb out of the recession if we just don't see employment data getting any better? What's your best guess on when kind of consumer confidence bounces back if unemployment numbers aren't going to? I assume if we're going to come out of this, it'll have to happen in the consumer confidence area. At what point does that happen?
Mr. Chairman, that's the $100 billion question or trillion-dollar question or $650 billion question maybe is the right. What we're in is we're in something that we don't usually have in a recession, and that is we're in a consumer-driven recession. And consumer spending depends upon, first of all, incomes. If you have more money, you spend more money. But it also depends upon wealth. If you're richer, if your stock portfolio, if your housing value is going up, you spend more money. About a nickel over 2 years for every dollar that your wealth goes up. It depends upon the unemployment rate. It depends upon consumer confidence. It depends upon the level of debt to net worth. Right now, wages are going down. Incomes are going down. Wealth in the last 2 years, actually the last five quarters, we've lost $13 trillion in wealth, household wealth. Applying that nickel per dollar, $5 per hundred on there, what that means is that other things equal, consumer spending would be $650 billion less than it would be given how much we've lost in wealth. Then there's the consumer confidence issue that you bring up. The consumer confidence index is at historic lows, not just at a low level, but at historic lows. The consumer sentiment index, which is a slightly different index, is at a very low level as well. The ratio of debt to net worth has obviously gotten worse, and the unemployment rate has gotten worse. We're in just a vicious downward spiral where bad things happen. Consumers read about it, cut back on spending. They cut back on spending. That causes more layoffs, more bad things to happen, which gets read about and moved on as well. Something has to happen to break that spiral, that downward spiral. Part of what is happening to break that downward spiral is the federal stimulus package. Federal stimulus package is not going to be as good as the administration advertises it. It is inadequate in that it is too small, and it is likely that there's going to be a need for another federal stimulus package. That said, it's going to generate somewhere between 2.2 and 2.5 million jobs over the next 18 months. That's 2.2 or 2.5 million jobs more than we would have had in its absence. In Minnesota, and there's another slide later on that I have, we are forecasting a loss of 120,000 jobs in the state with the stimulus package. Without the stimulus package, we would have lost another 45,000 jobs, according to our estimates.
In addition to the 120?
Yes. We are forecasting a loss of 15,000 jobs in the construction industry. In the absence of the stimulus package, we would have lost 22,500, or about 50% more. So part of it is the stimulus package. But it's not going to be enough, and it's probably going to have to, they're probably going to have to do something as well again later this summer or this fall. My guess is.
Dr. Stinson, what is, there's probably little the state government can do, but I've had the opportunity to visit with a lot of large contractors, large developers, who tell me they have a number of good projects under contract, but just can't get financing from the banks. Is there any anything we could do at the state level, or is anything the federal government additionally could do to try and get some of these projects that are ready to go off the ground?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
That's an interesting question in that what may be seen as a viable project by a developer who already owns the land and thinks he has a potential market for it may not be a viable project. And at this point, given what's going on in the housing industry in particular, in 2009, well, we've overbuilt housing. There's absolutely no doubt we overbuilt housing, and we're working down that surplus in housing. In 2009, estimates are nationally we would have somewhere on the order of 500,000 to 600,000 housing starts. That's a third less than we had in 2008, where we were in the 900,000 housing start area. But 2008 was the lowest level of housing starts since World War II, that we hadn't been under a million per year since World War II nationally. So there's more going on here than simply a lack of access to credit in terms of the housing area. In terms of the residential, non-residential construction, the buildings, things like that, developers will tell you that you've got to have new roofs in order to have new demand for grocery stores and gas stations and things like that. So if there's not this new housing development going on, there's not going to be the non-residential construction activity as well. That's coming, you know, in a year, 2 years, that cycle's going to start back up again. We'll move back up to above a million starts a year, although we're not going to go back up to the very high levels that we had before. But it's going to take a while to work through the inventory that's out there. And so I really don't think there's much that can be done in terms of the financing area. My own prescription for how state government can help, I mean, the state government is very constrained because of constitutional requirements for balanced budget. And, you know, taking money out of one pocket and spending it another way can make marginal differences, you know, not spending on land but spending on labor-intensive kinds of things makes a difference in terms of employment. But the other thing that could, I think, make a difference is directing or redirecting capital outlays towards repair and renovation, which are more labor-intensive and can be done quicker than new building kinds of authorizations and things like that. That historically, only about 15% of the capital budget allocation gets spent in the next fiscal year after it's authorized because of the startup problems. And here, given that you have the possibility of fairly quickly getting money into the system by through repair and renovation, what I'd call paintbrush ready rather than shovel ready kinds of activities, you know, that may be a way that the state can help. Certainly, you know, you're not going to change things. You're not going to generate 30,000 jobs. You're not going to generate 20,000 jobs. But in the construction industry, 1,000 jobs, 2,000 jobs would make a lot of difference.
Dr. Stinson, my good friend Senator Langseth proposed yesterday a capital investment bill that does, I think, kind of what you've outlined. I've indicated to him that I thought his number was a little too low. Is his bonding bill too small?
Mr. Chairman, I have no idea what the size of the bonding bill is even, and you know, it really depends upon the quality of the projects that are available. Stuff that is not going to get spent until 2011, you know, that's not going to help. It's what can you do now? And now is in April. I mean, that's where you need to be.
Senator Langseth, are there other projects that you didn't fund that are ready to go?
Mr. Chair, yes, there are many of them. But the one question I asked, a lot of it is repairs, you know, and that's almost all going to be done this year. But the question I asked on a lot of the other projects was, are you going to be able to get going on them right away? And in almost all cases, that's the case. It won't all be done this calendar year, but I don't know if there's any of it that'll go into 2011. But if people demand that I go higher, I will go higher.
So there are additional projects?
Oh yes. There's many of them that are ready to go.
Mr. Chairman, it's a good thing we closed that bill up, otherwise.
Is it Senator Pogemiller that held your number down, or Senator Cohen, or?
Well, Cohen is probably the one that flinched the most. But I started at 300 and I ended up at 328, so I was moving in the right direction.
Maybe we should have waited a few more days to close it up.
No. Well, we can always add to it.
Sure.
Senator Rest.
Not about the bonding bill.
On bonding?
On the bonding. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Stinson, one of the things we've heard, and I mean this as a serious question because I don't know the answer, is that because of the state of the economy, we're getting designers, lawyers, architects being laid off too. Does that with regards to getting stuff in the pipeline? Because if you can get some projects going, you might stop laying off architects, designers, lawyers. It seems like it's so pervasive right now in terms of the downsizing in the construction area. It's not just the blue-collar workers, not just electricians. It's everybody. I mean, Gregory Benson laid off something like 30 or 40 lawyers who their job basically was land transactions and things, and it's just there's nothing going on. And so I'm wondering how that factors into your thinking on this, how we should be thinking about a bonding bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, I still think that the biggest bang for the buck comes from renovation and repair, that you get more wages and salaries paid per dollar of total expenditure out of that, because you don't have as much equipment and material costs and things like that are going on. Now, I admit that lawyers don't have a lot of equipment that they have to purchase and or anything like that when they're doing that work, but I just think that the multiplier that is stronger on repair and renovation than anything else at this time.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
And do you think if somehow the credit markets and banking structure got stabilized, that would start to bring back the designers and the lawyers, because then some deals would get closed? Is that kind of the way we need to think about that, rather than we need to create a bonding bill for it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, having credit markets stabilize is certainly a necessary condition for things to come back, but it's not the only necessary condition. At this point, you're not going to have a lot of commercial development going on until you have housing starting to come back. And once housing start, and for housing to start to come back, you're going to have to work through the foreclosures, and you're going to have to start moving, have an increased demand. At this point, you know, it's very hard to have people moving up from an existing house to another house because they don't know if they can sell their existing house, and so they're not even in the market. Once credit markets start to work, and once you have a situation where the normal flow of move up in housing begins to go on again, then you'll get some of that stimulation. But that's more than a year away. And the question is, how do we get over the next year?
Mr. Chairman, then two quick. One, I think, is for Commissioner Mr. Schulhofer. And the other, the first one's for you, Mr. Stinson. Is there kind of a rule of thumb that, you know, if we do a $1 billion bonding bill every cycle, every 2 years, what percent of kind of the construction industry is that? Is that 10% or?
Mr. Chairman, I honestly don't know what the total construction. I can tell you, you know, I can look it up, but I don't have those.
If you would kind of get a sense of what that is, that would be helpful. And then how much, Commissioner, Mr. Showalter, how much bonding authority has been given that just hasn't gotten out yet because they haven't been able to close the deals and stuff?
Mr. Chair, much of what we did a year ago in projects, not in the, you know, come to asset preservation, a lot of that's done already, but most of the projects now are really going full board this year. That Duluth project and I believe the Bemidji project and so on. So they're now really going to be going full board. So there's a lot of what we did a year ago that is going to be done now this year.
Is there stuff left over, though, that we just...
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, I think Jim is looking up the number, but Senator Langseth's correct that for the $1 billion bonding bill we did last year, a lot of those projects are going to gear up this year, but we also have projects still moving forward from the $1 billion bill from a couple of years ago. We've had $2 billion bills in 3 years, so we have a lot of backed up capacity moving forward.
But it's in process. It's not like it's not going to happen. It's just plugging along. Okay, because I was wondering, you know, it doesn't make, if it was the opposite, if we had a lot of stuff just sitting there that we had given authorization for, but it wasn't moving forward, then it doesn't matter how big our bonding bill is. But you're saying there is not a backup of capacity.
No, we
We're plugging along. Okay.
You know, we did a bond sale in January, so we have the funds available to move projects forward.
Mr. Chair, Senator, Majority Leader, that number is in the debt capacity report that was transmitted along with the forecast. I don't have it with me, but certainly your staff
We'll look it up. Okay. Thank you very much.
But Commissioner, all of these projects that are in the pipeline that we've previously authorized bonds for, I mean, isn't all of that income tax that's generated, all that sales tax that's all generated on all those purchases, isn't that already all figured into the forecast? I mean, that's not... isn't going to make our current forecast any better. Isn't that already all factored in, that economic activity?
No.
Yes.
Dr. Stinson?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is already factored in.
Right. It's not anything Senator Langseth does would be new, but the past two bonding bills are already factored.
Dr. Stinson, refresh my memory. It seems like I asked one time of the what percentage of the sales tax that the state collects is related to construction?
Mr. Chairman, it's one of the three largest portions of the sales tax. And if I could tell you, if you got a forecast book, I don't think I have a forecast book. If we actually have a forecast book, I could. It's in the forecast book. On page 70 of the forecast book, we have the sales tax base. And for 2009, the total, this is an index number, but it's 68.3, and the proxy share of construction spending is 5.7 down at the bottom of the page. See where I'm at? Take column 2009 and then the February 2000 baseline on the synthetic sales tax base at the top of the page, 68.297. And then down at the bottom of the page, proxy share of construction spending, 5.732. So it's like maybe 8% or something like that.
That appears to be significantly lower from where we were, for instance, in 06 or 07.
Yes, we were like 12% in 06. So, you know, the decline in construction activity has had an impact on the sales tax base. I mean, that's one of the things that we marveled at, actually, is how much of the loss in sales tax revenue has come about because of the loss in construction.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stenson, I have a more general question going back to the decrease in GDP, and it is I have a very fuzzy notion of what factors are included in that calculation in terms of categories. Could you just refresh my memory on that? What's included in GDP?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, the easiest way to think about it, GDP is it's everything that's produced, the value of everything that's produced in the country. And on an inflation-adjusted basis, what we're going to have is 3.7% decline in the total output of goods and services. So that includes all the things that consumers buy. It includes all the things that businesses buy. It includes all the things that governments buy. And then it's net exports and imports, so all the things that foreigners buy minus the things that we buy from foreigners. What's different about this recession compared to others is that because we have a very low growth in inflation as well, what it means is not only on an inflation-adjusted basis is that going to decline, but on an actual dollar value,
so when
money
you're talking
going
about real GDP, it does not, it's not, the inflation is not there.
Yeah, real, there's no inflation. But here, even if you take inflation in, what it means is that there, that all businesses in the country combined are going to take in less money in 2009 than they took in 2008.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Though MVEST is only a small part of the general fund budget and soon to become no part of the general fund budget, it's a major portion of the transit budget, and it's been extremely volatile in years past. Now, in this last year, of course, it's pretty much collapsed, and so it's our ability to predict its performance, I know, has been severely hampered because I don't think anyone expected this kind of fall off in MVEST. It's been pretty sobering to see an anticipated $43 million budget cut to Metro Transit. Now we're up to 60-some million dollar budget. And a big portion of that is represented by MVEST's collapse. There's some other reasons, too, that we factor into that forecasted deficit. But I sent a communication to you last September. We haven't had a chance yet. I haven't heard from you yet about it, but I'll renew the question here. Is there something, when we get to slightly more normal circumstances, this inability to forecast MVEST and its volatility has been true for a long time. Is there something different we should be doing when we're looking at that particular source or factoring in a higher level of volatility so Metro Transit doesn't always seem to be caught so unawares every year when it's trying to budget?
Mr. Chairman, Senator volatility is movement from the trend, and it's up and down. And I don't think Metro Transit's complaining about the up part. What they're complaining about is that the trend itself is lower than they thought it was going to be when more money was dedicated out of the motor vehicle sales tax. And unfortunately, while in the last year or so, things have been really unfortunate. The motor vehicle sales tax is on a lower trend growth rate, and that is unlikely to change. Their expectations when this was when this transfer was made was that motor vehicle sales tax collections were going to be on a higher trend growth rate than they are. Frankly, with the demographics the way they are, with competition the way it is, I don't see that there's going to be any improvement in the growth, in the trend growth rate the motor vehicle sales tax. So that said, you know, it's up to you and the rest of the legislature and the governor to decide how you adjust their take, the transit funds take of the state's resources. But I think that hoping for a sudden increase, a surge in car buying that has that goes on for a long period, I think that's wishful thinking.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I appreciate hearing that, and I agree with you completely. And so what I'm hoping is that the forecast documents that even as recently as a few days ago, we see these upward trends, though less than what had been anticipated back in 2001, and that upward trend has dropped down, but it's still a pretty steep slope going up. Meanwhile, the reality that we track is it's actually down, even as the percentage increases. So what I'm hoping is what we know to be the case somehow also is reflected in communicating that in our forecast, so we don't kind of hope that we're budget against these forecasts that come out that become so dramatically off. I mean, sure, I'd love it to be volatile on the upside, but the fact is, since 2001, it's been pretty volatile on the downside only.
Well, Senator Dibble, when we got away from the property tax and moved to a more volatile revenue stream, we've all noticed that.
Yeah, I've been wondering why that was a good idea. Although I did vote against that.
There were people at this table that thought it was a good idea. Senator Dibble, I think the challenge for the transit advocates as it relates to that volatile revenue stream is to not spend up to what's forecasted and try to show some restraint in spending maybe to what some historic trend line has been rather than spending forecasted revenue then that maybe is not sustainable.
Well, I think there are two solutions. One is we not forecast so optimistically, and the second is your point, which frankly the council has been doing. They've been building in a 10% plus cushion, kind of discounting the MBEST forecast, but that hasn't proven sufficient either. So I think ultimately the solution is, as Dr. Stinson said, we need to take a look at what revenue and what resources we're using, but as long as we rely so much on MBEST, and it's not now just transit, we're going to spend MBEST for a lot of things across the entire state, we need to be pretty skeptical of what we're anticipating.
Dr. Stinson, we've got more slides, I think.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Johnson first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this, Dr. Stinson, this goes back to the slide you were working on. I have a question about, as we go across to 2010, it looks like we're, or at least I'm interpreting that we're actually in a recovery. Your opinion on that, is that optimistic?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I think that it's a little bit optimistic at this point. But the second half of 2010, the first half of 2011, I would expect we would be back to more normal growth rates. So the question is, what about the first half of 2010, the two bars that are right above the 2010 number? That's what the question is. You know, I'm not ready to throw in the towel on 2010 yet and say the economy is going to shrink through 2010.
Dr. Stinson, how do we get, if unemployment is flat, say it's flattened off in 2010, how do we get GDP growth if we're not improving the unemployment picture?
Mr. Chairman, there are a couple things that are going on. I mean, one of the things that obviously has to happen is that credit markets have to return to something closer to normal. But assuming that goes along, what's the next thing that has to happen? What has to happen is that consumer spending has to start growing. Now, it doesn't have to grow at a 5% rate or anything like that, but it can't be shrinking like it's been shrinking lately. And what that gets at is, do people, one, begin to feel more secure? What happens in a recession is that people cut back their spending because they fear for their jobs, and they build up precautionary balances. They save more. And that causes consumer spending to decrease because, you know, it's just the other side of the coin. You either can spend the money or save the money. So to the extent that you build up precautionary balances, then you're not spending, and so that reduces consumer demand. Over time, two things happen with that. One is that people get a little bit more comfortable with the current uncertainty of their situation, and so they're not quite as frightened as they were before. The rumors, while there are still rumors that are everybody's going to be laid off next week, it's, you know, the 33rd week in a row that there have been those rumors, and so they're a little less scary than the first few weeks that you hear them. Second is you get those precautionary balances built up to a more reasonable level, and so you're a little bit more comfortable with them, so you begin to start spending a little bit more. So at some point you get those precautionary balances built up to a more acceptable level. That frees up additional money to be spent in there. And then, of course, we have the lower tax situation that's created as part of the president's stimulus program, where that's dumping a little bit of money into the economy as well. Now, that said, you know, that's kind of the traditional point of view in terms of how we make this transition back to spending again. This time, we're in a different situation demographically. And those of you that have heard the state demographer Tom Gillespie and me talk, you know that we're fascinated with the implications of the aging of the baby boom. And here, what's happened in addition to, or what we believe is happening, in addition to this accumulation of precautionary balances to protect against being laid off, is that people are also saying, wait a minute, my 401k, my retirement accounts, all the assets that I put away to live off of retirement have shrunk, and they've shrunk dramatically. And if I'm going to retire, not even in the situation that I thought I was going to be in, but in just a reasonable situation, I'm going to have to start saving more money in addition to building up that precautionary balance. And so that's going to take a shot at consumer spending as well. But once you get up to some normal savings rate, you change your behaviors, so you're saving an extra $100 or $200 a month, as your income increases, it's probably not likely that your savings is going to increase dollar for dollar with the increase in income. And so there's going to be a little bit more available to be spent out of there. But it's a long, slow process. And because it's a long, slow process, the recovery out of this recession is going to be slower than we think, than any recovery that we've seen so far. To give you an example, if you look at the projections for Minnesota, our projections for Minnesota, for how long it's going to take to get back to the employment level that we had in the start of this recession in the fourth quarter of 2007, it's going to take 5 years before we get back to where we were. Now, some of you were around during the recessions, the twin recessions of the 80s. And there we had a recession in 1980 and then a second recession in 1981, 82. If you plot the same pattern there, 5 years after the start of the recession in 1980, we were 2%. We had 2% more employment even after going through two recessions. So this is, you know, a much shallower recovery, and it's due to the fact that the we think, due to the fact that the demographics are just going to mitigate against people going out and buying as much. About 10% more of the population over the age of 20 was between the age of 20 and 40 in 1980, at the start of the twin recessions in the 1980s. Those are people who are in their high buying years. They're not the people who are attuned to saving for retirement. And that change in the composition of households is something that's going to have an effect on the recovery here. It could be that it goes on longer. I mean, that's a concern. I think that it's not, but there's no guarantee.
So, Dr. Stinson, what percentage of the population going into this recession was the percentage greater than 50?
Mr. Chairman, the percentage greater than 65 was roughly the same. The percentage from 50 to 65, I think, is like 4 or 5% more, and then there's another 3 or 4% more for the 40 to 45s and the 45s to 50s. So, yeah, Mr. Showalter just got out a graph that I've used in the past. It's about 25% is 50 to 65, and about 21.5% in 1980. And so there's about a 3.5% swing there. There's a 2.5% swing on the 40 to 45s, a 3% swing on the 45s to 50s.
And that demographic change, we anticipate, will slow the recovery.
It seems to me that that's likely to. I mean, I think about people that I know, and they're more concerned about rebuilding their retirement accounts than they are about buying another television or those kinds of things. And so that's what I think is going to happen. Now, there's going to be an adjustment, obviously, in people's expectations as to how well off they're going to be in retirement. Reflects the realities of the fact that you're just not going to be able to rebuild those savings that you thought you had. But. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. The next chart is a chart that shows the cumulative impact of the job loss in Minnesota and kind of the pattern that we've had here. We've talked about that. We've talked about the fact that the without the stimulus package, instead of being 120,000 jobs lost, it'd be 165,000 jobs lost. You can see the very slow recovery. The fact that at the end of 2011, we're still 57,000 jobs below where we were at the start of the recession there, and it's not until the end of 2012 that we get back to where we were. I don't know if anybody has any questions on that, but we've kind of covered that. The next chart is the recession could be worse than forecast. Some of you who were at leadership briefing on the November forecast know that this same chart was in there, and it turned out to be prophetic. Now it looks like, given where things are, that the recession could be even worse than was it forecast in this forecast as well.
So, Dr. Stinson, the probability that the recession is going to be worse is?
Higher.
Significantly?
Yes. There was in February, the probability assigned to the baseline forecast was 60%, and a 20% probability assigned to the pessimistic forecast. Now you'd have to assign a much higher probability to the pessimistic forecast, maybe, 40-40 or something like that. The final chart is what to watch for. these are the things that if you want to be your own economic forecaster, to look for over the next 6 months in the news. Normally, I tell people that the one number to pay attention to is what's called the payroll employment number. It's not the unemployment rate. It's the other number that shows up in the newspapers. And here, again, I was telling them that last week that this is a little bit difficult to interpret at this point because what may seem like bad news may actually be good news. And my example was that if last Friday we would have heard that the U.S. economy lost 400,000 jobs in the month of February, that would have been good news because we were expecting we were going to lose 600, 650. It turned out we lost 650, and then that they also revised jobs numbers for the prior 2 months down. So that's still the most important number, but you're going to only see incremental progress on that. Everybody expects that we'll lose 600, 700,000 jobs in the month of March. This is not it's not an easily interpreted piece of good news or anything like that. The item that has to turn around for the economy to start growing is what you've already identified, which is consumer spending. Those numbers come out every month, and that's a number that really you need to pay attention to, that you can pay attention to what's happening to consumer spending, or you can pay attention to what's happening to the savings rate, because they're just, again, two sides of the same coin. If the savings rate is continuing to go up, then consumer spending is not going up. If the consumer spending is going up, then savings rate is not going up. And so it's that that's going to tell you, going to give you the first sign that we've turned the corner and that the economy is actually on its way out. The other issues, obviously, are what's happening to 2008 final payments and refunds, and what's happening to the withholding and the gross sales tax receipts on the forecast. On April 10th, we'll put out an economic update that'll track how withholding receipts and how sales tax receipts, among other things, have held up compared to the forecast. If, you know, we're way below expectations, that's an indication that the forecast was excessively optimistic. If we have a nice balance in withholding tax receipts and sales tax receipts for the months covered, that's an indication that the economy's turning up a little faster than we had expected, and so that'd be good news.
Senator Squire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Stinson, we've talked in the past about this savings rate and how actually having a positive savings rate is a good thing, and we appear to have achieved that without an interest rate increase. But is there any chance that we will be able to see income growth that would sustain a positive savings rate and consumer spending? You talked a little bit about it. If the, you know, we achieve some level of savings, that consumer spending can start up again. But is there any chance we can get both of them? And is there any connection to interest rates in that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, yes, I think we can have a situation where we have sufficient income growth where consumer spending is increasing and savings are increasing, we're at some level, 5% of income is saved and 95% of it's spent, and so then if you go from $100 to $110, that spent an additional $9.50 on consumer spending and save an additional 50 cents. The problem comes in getting from the zero savings rate to the 5% or 6% or 7% savings rate that turns out to be more optimal. For a long period, and it's again, it's in the forecast book, there's a graph in the forecast book that shows you savings rates were 7%, and the company and the country was growing, the economy was growing. Then we kind of scaled back our savings in part, probably due to appreciation in housing values and appreciation in the stock market, and allowed that to substitute. What's causing the pain right now is that we're now moving our savings rates back up to that long-term equilibrium rate. And the question is, how quickly do we get there, and what is that long-term equilibrium rate? Is it 5% where we've been the last couple of months, or is it going to be more like 7%? Or is it going to drop down to 3%? You know, if it people suddenly say, well, wait, I'm okay at 3%, you know, then you suddenly have a little bounce in consumer spending as well. Interest rates are obviously going to be important. You know, if you get a tenth of a percent interest on your bank savings account, you're much less likely to put money into the bank savings account than if the interest rate is 3% or 4%. So that's going to make a difference as well.
And Mr. Chair, Dr.
Sinskoy,
is anybody making any forecasts as to where that interest rate might be falling out and going in the future?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, there are literally thousands of forecasts of interest rates. So that's one of the things that everybody wants to know. We're in a difficult situation, though, and the difficult situation is that the large banks in particular are not particularly financially strong, and so one of the ways that they rebuild their balance sheets is by borrowing money from you and me and the Federal Reserve at a very low interest rate and then lending it at a much higher interest rate. So part of the reason for this large spread between the amount of interest paid on deposits and the interest rate charged on debt so that, that they take over is that this is a way that the banks can rebuild their balance sheets and heal themselves without direct federal intervention. And so that's kind of the other side of this. This third thing on the slide, what to watch for, improvements in credit markets, that's part of where the improvement in credit markets is going to come from, is from that spread. And eventually people will begin to be willing to pay a little bit more just because they'll be seeking out more deposits. The market can work in this situation. It's just that it's going to take what may seem like an unreasonably long time.
And one final. Is the TARP money a relatively high-cost money for the banks, and is it enough to affect interest rates overall?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, the TARP money to this point hasn't been used in that way. The TARP money has been dumped directly into it to keep banks solvent. It's not been to add to liquidity in there. Now, what will happen from here on and this TALF money that you may have heard about in the last few days, that's another source of money. Again, these are all ways of increasing both the financial stability and the liquidity of the banks in there. And, you know, what you hear is that the TARP money is not going to be sufficient, that they're going to need another substantial piece of money there that's going to have to come about. But if you're not one of the insiders, you know, there's no real way that you can tell.
Thank you.
Dr. Stinson, had the savings rate gone negative prior to this recession? I mean, were people actually spending more money than they were earning? Was that somehow a contributing factor to kind of the financial collapse? Had it actually gotten to a negative point?
Mr. Chairman, the savings rate is determined not by the number of dollars in a bank account or anything like that. The way that savings rate is determined is taking after-tax personal income, what's called disposable personal income, and subtracting consumption from it. Okay. If you have a stock market gain and you sell your stock, you're going to have a tax due, capital gains tax due on that. You pay the tax out of the savings that you are out of the proceeds of the sale of the stock. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that tax that you paid out of the proceeds from the sale of the stock is subtracted from your earnings, your wages and salaries, mm-hmm. like it was just on your wages and salaries. And so it created a situation where if you had large stock market gains as an economy, and we did have substantial stock market gains in some years as an economy, the tax that was paid on those stock market gains, even though it came out of reduction in or out of the gain on the stock, was treated as a loss, as a reduction in your income, mm-hmm. to disposable income. So that drove the savings rate negative. The savings situation was never as bad as it appeared, although comparatively over time we had taken a lot more out than we should have. So the answer to your question is, in a complicated way, yes, you know, that the lower savings rate was a problem for us, but it wasn't as easily understood as you might think.
So consumption, spending on consumption was higher than aggregate personal income?
Yes.
Senator Squay.
Well, Mr. Chair, Dr. Stinson, but would your analogy be more accurate if it would have been they would have been spending the value increases in their housing, and that is kind of what was driving that percentage that looked negative to negative, because people's housing values were going up and they were doing second mortgages and whatever, and a lot of that might have been artificial. I mean, it wasn't real, as we found out.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Squay, yes, you're right. People financed their consumption with mortgage equity withdrawals, refinance their housing, take an extra $20,000 out to do something else with or something like that. And it was clearly not sustainable, and it turned out to be not sustainable.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was thinking the same thing, and now that you've gone in that direction, looking at this chart, Dr. Stinson, my thinking on this is, you were talking about the recession of 81 and 82. I think the reason we came out of that quicker is because we still were in love with this artificial, intangible wealth, this paper wealth that we had built up in the system, the Enrons and all of those things were still in place. And I think in this recession, we're going to see the collapse of all that artificial wealth, the inflation of homes, the way people can build their wealth on paper. I think that is no longer acceptable in this society. I think once we weed all that out, we'll, at the other end of this, when we come out of this, are we going to have a more stable economy? Do you think, is that possible? Or are we going to still keep building our portfolios in kind of a intangible sort of way.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I don't think that the desire for more wealth is going to go away, and so I think that people are still going to be seeking to maximize income, maximize wealth when they do things. I think that's just the nature of economic behavior. I think people are going to be more aware of potential downside risk. For a large number of people, the risk profile of investments was distorted because they hadn't ever seen a severe economic downturn. They thought the trees grow to the sky, basically. And so I think that there's going to be a repricing or recognition of a different risk profile for investments than they had before. And that's going to probably make things a little bit more stable in there. But I don't think that there's going to be a fundamental change in underlying human behavior.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, if we have a more stable economy, we won't need economists like Dr. Stinson.
Yeah. So obviously we would say no.
Dr. Stinson, before we go back to the commissioner, Mr. Showalter, the question all of us boomers want to know that are in that demographic decile approaching retirement, where's the stock market going to be at the end of the year?
Mr. Chairman, if I knew, I would invest, and then I would tell you and everybody else so that my investments would go up.
Has it hit bottom yet, do you think?
Global Insight is fairly optimistic about where the stock market's going to be at the end of the year. And so that gives you pause about our capital gains assumption, since the stock market's part of our equation for estimating capital gains. And my friend Dan Laufenberg, who is the chief economist for Ameriprise, was asked this question at a forum that he and I were. It was interesting that they asked him the question, not me. He said historically the stock market goes up about 6 months before the economy turns up. And so if you believe Dan's forecast, which at that time was that the economy was going to turn up in a couple of weeks from now, that you should have already been in the stock market. We'd already seen the lows. Said if you believe Tom's forecast, you got until August or September before you see a need to catch the bottom of the stock market. So.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're kind of doing a round robin on the economy. When Senator Johnson brought up 1982, I remember that the interest rates were considerably higher than they were, but we didn't have as high an unemployment problem as we did, as we do now.
Yeah,
and
we have
at that time in 1982, didn't you have a Reagan administration that was beginning to downsize the budget of government from the Carter years?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, Mr. Chairman, you may remember this better than I do, but I think the unemployment rate in the early 1980s, particularly in northern Minnesota, was substantially higher than it is right now. And I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think that Duluth Superior Metropolitan Labor Area was well in excess of 10%, and I think the numbers 15% and 17% stand out to me, but I'm not 100% sure of that. But the unemployment rate was very high.
Okay.
Interest rates were very high for a couple of reasons. One was that if you think about interest rates, the way you got to think about interest rates is that you charge enough so that you get your money back on your pool, and so there's a risk premium that's part of interest rates. There's a premium, it's called social time preference. You know, what do you have to pay somebody to get them to forego consuming today and wait until tomorrow to consume? They won't do it for nothing. You have to give them a percent or a percent and a half or something like that. And then you have to factor in the underlying inflation. And the underlying inflation at that time was very high. And so what we were actually in a situation was when you factored in the underlying inflation, for a while in the early 1980s, we had negative real interest rates, even though those interest rates were very high in there, that if you took into account what inflation was, they were negative. So there's another thing that was going on at the time in the 1980s, and that is that, again, Senator Bok's generation was just moving into the period where they were looking to acquire goods, and so they were in what in economists would call the net borrower phase, and that cohort was so big compared to the people in the net saver phase that in order to draw enough money out of them into savings so that the baby boom generation could have the money to borrow, interest rates had to go very high. What we've seen, of course, is that as the baby boomers move from that net borrower phase into the net saver phase, interest rates drop because suddenly they were savings, and the cohort that followed them that has the high demand for credit was much smaller, and so that went on there.
Mr. Chair, I remember in 1982 interest rates were moving quickly up from 16 to maybe 18% for a mortgage interest rate. And, you know, being a practitioner in the real estate business, we weren't making sales. We were actually, though, making more sales then than we are now at an interest rate in the mid 5 percentage points. Yeah. And part of that reason was is we had more options and creative financing opportunities allowing us to do that. We could write wrapped contract for deeds. There was a lot of mortgages that were assumable. People would get into their private financing arrangements with their new buyers. This world is not like that. No mortgage company allows assumptions of loans. It's practically illegal via contract that you can't write an overall contract for deed over a pre-existing first mortgage. Mortgage companies won't allow that either. And now on top of it, you've also gone back to the mortgage qualification standards that were more reminiscent of about 10 and 12 years ago, very strict, not taking any margin of risk at all. So even though people may have the opportunity to enjoy a 5.5% mortgage rate, they can't get it unless you have sterling credit rating. Sterling credit report is the only way you can get a loan nowadays. And, of course, the ever-present need for 20% down. And so it's much harder now to re-engage the real estate market. Now, when we look at the real estate market and everything that's tied to housing and construction, Dr. Stinson, maybe you could tell me, what would be the gross state product of the jobs that emanate from a healthy real estate industry? Is that, I've heard roughly about 18 to 20% of all jobs in Minnesota are somewhat related or connected to the housing industry. And when that's flat, we've got a really big problem. Wouldn't you agree?
Mr. Chairman, the problems of the housing industry are certainly serious, and the fact that they're not just flat, but that the housing industry has been declining has certainly been a major contributor to the weakness in the state's economy. Mm-hmm. I think that the number and the percentage of the gross state product that's directly tied to the housing industry may be a little bit overstated. It may not be quite 18 or 20%. It's probably more like around 10% or something like that. But still, I mean, it's an enormous sector. It's an important sector, and there's just no doubt that that's been a problem, not just in Minnesota but in other states as well, in terms of what's helped precipitate the weakness in the economy that we're observing now.
Mr. Chair, the only reason I bring this up is I'm and maybe I'm a bit biased being a realtor, but usually what's good for real estate is good for Minnesota, and it certainly is a reflection of the health of the economy. But if you can't buy a house and if you can't put people to work in the housing industry, I think we all agree that that's a major impact on the production of goods and services and salaries and just financial security of our state. If that doesn't come around, and if there isn't a little more loosening for not necessarily the government programs that are coming out of the Obama administration, which is more focused on the low-end income producer, we've got to focus on middle class. The middle class is going to be the big tide that rises all boats. And if we don't do that, I think we're in for a long period, a longer period than what some people say. I think the recession will – I don't see the light at the end of the tunnel right now.
Senator Limmer, that 5% mortgage you referenced, right, I think you can actually get them lower than that even. But what's a sterling credit score?
I would say
what kind of number is that?
I would say right now on a credit score, I think you're a sterling. You know, 800 is the absolute perfect I think you can get, and most everyone cannot get that. But I think anything over about a 720 would be a very respectable score.
That would allow you to get that mortgage?
Yeah, and then you have to have the adequate down payment to put down on the table as well.
You still need 20% down to get that?
Not necessarily. You can do less than that, but then that will trigger a mortgage insurance premium, which increases your monthly payment, and it makes it harder for you to qualify for a loan. And of course, if you're buying a townhouse or a condominium, then you've got association dues that go against your payment ratio, so that makes it even tighter. So, you know, families are going to be a little hard-pressed to find it, especially if you've lost a job. Your credit history may be at risk of having some severe negative blows on it right now, and then you've got to wait because there's no mortgage out there for you anymore. Part of the issue that we created in relaying to foreclosure, in response to the foreclosure market, what we created reactionary as it was, we said most of these creative loans in the past were no longer available in Minnesota. We made a law. And some of the people that are making commission sales, that was the only way they could get a mortgage. Now their ARM rates are exploding in value. They can't make their payment as they once did, although they had a traditional good payment history. Their payments jumped sky high as a result of the ARM lock going off, and now there's no product for them to refinance on. So our foreclosure problem is not only immediate, it's going to be prolonged for the next 4 to 5 years until these ARM rates kind of get through the system. But we don't have a product, and this state government has not responded to it as well. So it's a difficult issue, and we're going to continue to have foreclosures probably for the next 4 to 5 years as a result.
Dr. Stinson, the low number of housing starts, by multiple years of that, are we developing some pent-up demand so that at some point housing will really starts will take off very sharply?
Mr. Chairman, if you look at the percentage growth rates, we're Now, well, we're in a position where we're going to have very high percentage growth rates just to get back to what would be a more normal level. But in terms of where we're going to end up in terms of the actual level of housing starts, we're not going to be at the 1.8, 1.9, 2 million level like we were for a while there. You know, the normal growth rate, the demographically appropriate growth rate might be somewhere in the 1.2 to 1.4 range, and that's more likely what we're going to be seeing. But we overbuilt. We had to work through that overbuilding. We're getting pretty well worked through that overbuilding, and then we'll go back up to the normal rate of household formation again. But, you know, I don't think you're going to see, you know, a 2-2 or something like that coming out of this where there's a lot of pent-up demand. It's just going to be back to more normal growth rate. We've worked through an excess inventory. That's what'll happen.
Something in the neighborhood of 1.5 million units a year?
Yeah, that might even be a little bit high for an average. You know, 1.4 maybe, somewhere in that range.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, those in the real estate industry are kind of realizing a perfect storm in the real estate industry. You don't have the growth of young families coming up demanding homes. You've got a baby boom population now wanting to downsize out of their larger homes. And what we thought was the new immigrant population, which would replace that demand, that isn't growing as it once was. So I don't think it's a good time to start being a brand-new contractor in the state of Minnesota. The long-term effect is just not there. And, you know, the state will have to go into a new direction in order to attract more people to move here, because that's the only option we have. And on a day like the weather like we have today, I don't think they're going to think about moving to Minnesota real fast from, well, everyone else is south of us, so we have to compete against that. But I would tend to think that the prices, because of that lack of demand, prices are going to continue to drop in excess of other states that, as they emerge out, they've got climate, maybe business climate, they've got other things that people move to other states for, and we don't seem to be changing our ways to change to attract it. So I don't think that we're going to have a robust real estate market, and I think most of the people in real estate have come to that conclusion. The economists that we hire, the demographic people, they're all pointing at the problem that we don't have a sustainable market to keep contractors building at the rate they are, and I think it's going to be considerably less. Would you,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, the state demographer Tom Gillespie and I have talked about this issue mm-hmm. to a lot of different groups and so on like that, and one of the points we make is that this isn't a Minnesota problem. That the demographics in Minnesota are not that much different from the demographics nationally in terms of the age distribution. And what that means is that it's going to be an increasingly competitive market to attract those new households in there. You know, there's nobody comes to Minnesota by accident. They come because there's a job here. I mean, there's not a lot of people on the beach in California saying that they're moving to Minnesota as soon as they turn 18 or anything like that. And so it does raise a question as to how do we build an environment, a total environment that's attractive to people moving to the state, that attracts people moving to the state. You know, what are our strengths? What do we emphasize? What's important in attracting people to the state.
We got a couple slides left, Commissioner.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if you can, and members, if you turn to the next page, it's no surprise to anyone that we the federal stimulus money is one time, and that we still have a structural problem in our budget. You can see it laid out for 10 and 11, as well as 12 and 13, and that our 12 and 13 deficit is $5.1 billion. That's up from the 4.6 that it was in the November forecast. And then finally, on the last page, we just lay out for you the full 8, 9, and 10, and 11 picture. That concludes our presentation.
Not a lot of good news, Commissioner.
Oh, sorry. Downhill from breakfast, Mr. Chairman.
Anything else, members? Commissioner, Mr. Showalter, Dr. Stinson, thank you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Remember, tomorrow morning, 8:30, we've got a mostly local bills up tomorrow. Committee's adjourned.